And here he is running through the Roman night, down the Appian Way. It's evening, it's torch lit, and this barefoot Ethiopian is running through the streets of the capital of the country that invaded his homeland only 25 years earlier. It was incredible, symbolic, and real event. Not only that, but he's coming through the Appian Way, and he approaches the Axum Obelisk, which had been dismantled and stolen by Mussolini's army and placed in the middle of Rome when they conquered Ethiopia. And Baby Bukila reaches the obelisk and just takes off.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. The Ethiopian marathoner Abibi Bukila became the first black African to win a gold medal. His competitors had snickered because he didn't wear shoes. Bukila is just one of an extraordinary cast of characters in David Marinus's new book. It's called Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. Marinus is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, and he's also authored best-selling biographies of former President Bill Clinton and coach Vince Lombardi. So he's deft at bringing together politics and sports. Marinus argues in Rome 1960 that the Games' intrigue, anguish, and triumphs marked a crucial evolution in an era defined by the Cold War, post-colonial politics, and the fight against racial discrimination. This reading of Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, took place in July 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
I sort of start with a confession. I totally backed into this book by accident. I really had no intentions of writing it. I was researching my book on Roberto Clemente, the great Puerto Rican baseball player. And his first terrific season was 1960. So I was combing through the sports sections of various newspapers in August and September of 1960, and I kept coming across these incredible names: Wilma Rudolph, Rafer Johnson, Abibi Bukila, Cassius Clay. And, you know, that's quite a group. And so it just kept banging me in the head, that's really something. But I would say to myself, no, I don't really want to write another sports book now. Carla Cohen would hate it. She doesn't want me to writing these sports books. And then I started looking at, well, what was going on in the world right at that moment? It was a very tense time in the Cold War. Right before the Olympics started in Moscow, there had been a show trial where Gary Powers, the pilot of the U-2 reconnaissance spy plane, which had been shot down over Soviet territory in May, well, his trial had just ended right before the Olympics began. Before the Olympics were over, Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, set sail from the Baltic across the Atlantic to the United Nations to pound his fist and rail against the West. So that was sort of the brackets of the Olympics. In Africa, 14 nations were getting their independence that very summer. It was a moment of great importance in the Cold War for that as well, because it was fertile territory in the Cold War. No one knew which way many of those... Is it that bad already? it wasn't clear which way many of those nations would go. In Asia... This was the summer of the debates between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. The campaign was underway, and the issue of the two Chinas was very much in the forefront. If you remember the debates, these little islands of Komoi and Matsu became sort of the symbols of whether the United States, what they would do to defend the island nation of Taiwan led by Chiang Kai-shek, who in 1960, some 12, 13 years after he was pushed off the island, was still trying to persuade the Eisenhower administration to invade the mainland. And then you had Germany. This was several months before the Berlin Wall went up, but many of the precursors of that tension were there already. During the very times of the Olympics, East Germany, in kind of an Orwellian move, closed its borders to the Westerners who wanted to come in there to have a celebration in Berlin. At the same time that thousands of East Berliners were trying to escape that very summer. So I had these great characters, and I had world events that were fascinating, but I still wasn't sure that they fit together. You know, there's often an attempt to cram context into a book that doesn't really belong there, and I was determined that I wasn't going to do that. But when I looked further, I saw that in every possible way, the politics, the sociology, the culture, and the sports intertwined in those 18 days in Rome. The Soviet-American tension of the Cold War was played out in many ways in those Olympics. First of all, in the most obvious way, in the medal count, it was part of the propaganda war as to which system was superior. And the Soviets in particular, every time they'd win a medal, they'd say it was because of the superiority of the Soviet system. Rome was teeming with spies and agents and attempts at defection. One of the stories of my book involves an American sprinter named Dave Sim, a medical student at Duke University. He was in the mid-50s considered the fastest man in the world. He'd been injured, couldn't compete in Melbourne in 56, made a comeback, made the team in 1960, and before they left New York for Rome, he was visited at his hotel in New York by an American intelligence agent who convinced him to come down to Washington. He went to Washington. They pulled out a dossier of Igor Terovenesian, a Soviet long jumper who they said was very westernized. He loved jazz. He'd been to Philadelphia in 1959 for the second of the dual meets between the Soviets and the Americans, and he just seemed like he was eager to become part of the West. So they wanted Dave Sim to soften him up in Rome, and they would close the deal while they were there, and he would defect. Sim was a patriot, and he said, sure, I'll do it. It sounds like fun. it wasn't very hard for athletes to from any country to get together in Rome during the events. And matter of fact, the Soviets and the Americans held practices together before it started. So they became friendly, and they went out to dinner. And then the way it was supposed to happen is at the second dinner, an agent would come and close the deal. And this agent, Dave Sim, only knew by the pseudonym Mr. Wolf. And that's all Igor knew, too, when I interviewed him. So Mr. Wolf comes in halfway through the dinner. And Igor Terovenesian grew up in the Ukraine, but he's from Armenia. His parents were from Armenia. And the agent knew all about this and immediately started talking to Terovenesian about Armenia and in the dialect of that territory. And it scared the heck out of Igor, as he told me. He jumped from his seat and said, Dave Sim, I trust you, I don't trust. And he walked out, and the defection failed. So there were no athletes who defected in Rome, although several officials and others did. Black Africa that summer was just becoming an important issue in terms of South Africa. In later Olympics, South Africa would be removed from the Olympics because it so clearly and obviously didn't live up to the Olympic ideal of no discrimination based on creed or color. But in 1960, the first efforts to somehow sanction South Africa were beginning. A movement had started in South Africa, an anti-apartheid movement dealing with sports. Their leader was a man named Dennis Brutus. He wrote many letters to Avery Brundage, the president of the International Olympic Committee, urging him to look harder at what was going on in South Africa and the obvious discrimination against black athletes. Brutus was not allowed a visa to go to Rome to talk further about it. As a matter of fact, the day he applied for his visa, South African police agents invaded his office and took all of his documents. But someone else, another representative, was allowed to meet in Rome with Avery Brundage and the International Olympic Committee leaders to make the case about the discrimination in South Africa. But Brundage and his cohorts, you know, sort of these old school guys, bought the argument of the South Africans that the only reason there were no blacks on the team is because no blacks were good enough athletes to make the team. That was still the way it was in that era. But the key moment for Africa in the Olympics came from a wonderful source and story. Ethiopia brought a squad of about 11 runners and cyclists to Rome. One of them was named Abebe Bikila, and he came to Rome with a pair of shoes that didn't fit him quite right. He got some blisters, so he decided to just chuck them. He didn't want to wear them. And he'd run many times through the hills of Ethiopia without shoes. So the marathon comes up. I interviewed the American marathoners. Gordon McKenzie told me he's standing at the Capitoline steps as the race is about to begin with his teammate, Alan Kelly. And he looks over and he sees this skinny little guy, all stick and bones, number 11, without any shoes on. And he says, well, that's one guy we don't have to worry about. And nobody worried about him because nobody had ever heard of him. The press corps thought his name was Bikila Abebe until about halfway through the race when all of a sudden they heard that Bikila was in the lead. And then they started trying to figure out who this was. And here he is running through the Roman night down the Appian Way. It's evening, it's torchlit, and this barefoot Ethiopian is running through the streets of the capital of the country that invaded his homeland only 25 years earlier. It was an incredible, symbolic, and real event. And not only that, but he's coming through the Appian Way, and he approaches the Axum Obelisk, which had been dismantled and stolen by Mussolini's army and placed in the middle of Rome when they conquered Ethiopia. And Abebe Bikila reaches the obelisk and just takes off. And he wins the race by minutes, the fastest time ever run in a marathon in Rome, in Mussolini, you know, the remnants of Mussolini's Rome, barefoot, arriving at the Arch of Constantine. And he was not just a great personal story, but an important moment in sports. He was the first. Think of all of the great distance runners to follow from East Africa. Dozens of them have won gold medals and other medals. And Abebe Bikila was the very first one. The issue of China was played out, or the two Chinas, was played out in Rome as much as it was anywhere else. A very interesting history to this. Mainland China, Communist China, had dropped out of the Olympic movement years earlier out of protesting the fact that Taiwan was allowed to compete in the Olympics. In 1956, Taiwan competed under the name the Republic of China. In 1959, Avery Brundage and the International Olympic Committee decided at a meeting in Munich that was ridiculous, that it wasn't really the Republic of China. It didn't represent China. It was an island nation. It had to call itself Taiwan or Formosa if it wanted to compete. This created a firestorm. The State Department went nuts, tried to lobby the entire world to overturn this decision. The right wing in the United States was mobilized. The John Birch Society started a massive letter-writing campaign, as did many conservative churches. If Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly were around then, it would have just been the issue of the day. And it was a pretty big issue anyway. And so Taiwan is under this pressure of the State Department actually wants them to boycott the Olympics rather than acknowledge themselves as Taiwan instead of the Republic of China. And it almost happened. But for one intervening fact, which had to do with sports, which was that Taiwan happened to have a great athlete, C.K. Young, who was a decathlete. He was then training and living in Los Angeles, going to UCLA, but he would compete for Chiang Kai-shek's Taiwan or the Republic of China. And they didn't want to lose that possibility. He would be the first medalist ever from the island. So they resisted the pressure from the State Department, decided to compete, and in a political moment during the opening ceremony, the leader of the Taiwanese delegation unfurled a banner that said, under protest. The Germanys were played out in an interesting way during the Olympics as well. They competed as one team. This was less than a year before the Berlin Wall went up. But again, the IOC said, you're not two countries. East Germany wasn't recognized as a separate country at that point. It was the Soviet sector of Germany. And so the International Olympic Committee said, if you want to compete, you'll have to do it as one team. They reluctantly agreed. Neither side wanted to really do it, but they all had athletes they wanted to compete with in the Olympics. And so they joined forces in sort of an unholy alliance. They agreed to certain compromises. Instead of playing the anthem of East or West, whenever a German won a gold medal, they played the Ode to Joy, Beethoven, which probably is better than any anthem. Of course it is, anyway. Instead of raising the flag of either side with the symbols of their countries, they raised just the flag with the colors and no symbols on it. And it turns out there were two athletes from Germany who sort of tell different sides of the story of that moment and of what was to follow. The first was Ingrid Kramer. She was a young diver from Dresden. She was 2 years old when Dresden was bombed. In the firebombing made famous by Slaughterhouse-Five, among other things, and was haunted by that moment for the rest of her life until we interviewed her. She said that she still had dreams 40 years later of an airplane chasing her, and that she remembered that several of her kindergarten classmates had white or gray hair, who knows why, but from the trauma of that moment. Anyway, Ingrid Kramer was 17 years old when she got to Rome, representing Germany, but representing East Germany. Her father was a functionary in the East German establishment. And she, Western writers immediately took to her because they were all sexist in that period, and they loved beautiful girls. It's stunning to read the accounts of the sports writers of that era. You know, if they're describing a woman athlete, usually they give the measurements. You know, gymnast Muriel Grossfeld, 36, 25, 35. Sports Illustrated did a 6-page takeout on a Canadian gymnast who finished about 18th place, but she was so good-looking, they just wanted to show the pictures. Anyway, Ingrid Kramer, they immediately called the Dresden Doll. And ran a lot of pictures, photos of her as well. Well, she won both the platform diving and the springboard diving, and so she was one of the great figures of the Olympics. And when she won, the East Germans said that it was because of the superiority of the socialist system. She was regarded as a hero when she got back to Dresden, or East Berlin and then Dresden. And she had a fairly successful career after that as a coach and a major figure in East German sports history. Now, years after 1960, the East German women in particular became infamous for the administering of testosterone and other doping to make them better athletes. Many of their lives were totally destroyed. Many of the women died because of what was administered to them, unbeknownst to them. They thought they were getting vitamins. Ingrid Kramer really had nothing to do with that. Diving was not a sport where that sort of doping would be of any advantage. And she wasn't involved in that. But when the two when East and West Germany reconciled in the late 80s, all of the East German coaches were essentially fired, including Ingrid Kramer. Her life took a dive because of the wonder of this reconciliation and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it's always sort of a poignant reminder about the unexpected impacts of certain events on certain people. That something that is in essence good for humanity can have a deleterious impact on an individual. The other classic German story of the Olympics involved a sprinter named Armin Hari. He's kind of my favorite rapscallion villain of the Rome Olympics. He was ran the 100-meter dash. He was called the thief of starts. Everyone was convinced that he cheated on his starts. In fact, he didn't. Photographers and videographers had studied it pretty thoroughly and just came to the conclusion that he just had the best instincts of any runner they'd ever seen. He could get off the blocks anticipating the start of the gun. a few hundredths of a second faster than anyone else. But Hari certainly didn't endear himself to the Americans before the event by refusing to meet with Jesse Owens, the hero of the 1936 games in Berlin, where he single-handedly took on the notion of Aryan superiority and won all those medals in the sprints and the long jump. And Owens was in Rome as writing a column and a radio reports for a Chicago newspaper, and he wanted to meet Armin Hari. Hari stood him up, said, "No, I don't have time for the guy." So Jesse Owens sort of took it in stride with the wonderful comment, "I've been stood up by bigger jerks before, but never by faster ones." In any case, Armin Hari was on the take and on the make during those Olympics. He won the gold medal fair and square after two false starts, one of which was counted against him. But he also won the gold medal wearing Adidas shoes that he was paid to wear. He was sort of the first breach of the amateur code. But better than that, there were two shoe companies in that era. They were both German companies, Adidas and Puma. And they were run by the Dassler brothers. The name Adidas comes from Adi Dassler. And Puma was run by Rudi Dassler. Well, Adi Dassler paid Armin Hari to wear Adidas shoes to run the race, which he did. Then he took off the Adidas and put on Pumas to go to the gold medal stand. So he's collecting from both sides. And kind of the unfettered capitalism at its sleaziest, which proved to be his essential character because many years later he ended up in prison for embezzling. In some ways, Armin Hari was kind of bringing in the era of individualism. He didn't really care what anybody thought. He had a big ego and was just out for himself. And another character with that same ego, but a much more lovable person, was Cassius Clay, who came to Rome at age 18 with the exact same personality he would have years later as Muhammad Ali, but none of the real importance or meaning behind it. He was just like the obstreperous little brother of the American squad. The other athletes would sort of roll their eyes when they saw Cassius coming, knowing that he was going to boast about how he was the greatest and that he was going to be the world champion soon. He was better than Floyd Patterson. He'd lick him, and he'd lick anybody from anywhere in any part of the world. Just getting Cassius to Rome was a struggle, however, because he was afraid to fly. He said, if God wanted us to fly, he'd give us wings. They had to give him sleeping pills to get him on the plane, but the sleeping pills didn't really work. He was yapping his way through all the way across the Atlantic. And by the second day, everybody was sick of him, but also entertained by him. He was, however, even then at age 18, a terrific boxer. And the finals of the boxing matches were held in the Palazzo dello Sport, this beautiful Italian modern architectural of an arena. And it was filled to the rafters, 18,000 fans there, 17,000 of them drunken Italians, and vociferously drunk Italians, who were singing like Caruso after every match if the Italians won, and intensely whistling and booing if their Italians lost. And there were five Italians in the final matches, so it was quite an evening. And right before Cassius Clay was to go out there, an American had been announced as the winner in a split decision that was very controversial. The Italians hated it. They were booing and whistling throughout the national anthem. Bing Crosby was in the crowd belting it out louder and louder to try to overcome all this whistling. And Cassius Clay is back in his dressing room realizing that he's in for it if he doesn't fight the best fight of his life, which he ended up doing. And he beat a big old left-handed Polish guy in what all of the boxing writers said was the best match of the Olympics. After the Olympics, he went back to Louisville, Kentucky, and as the mythology goes, he encountered some racism at a restaurant in Louisville a few weeks later and was so distraught by the hypocrisy of this winning a gold medal for his country, which in Rome he talked openly about how much he loved America and thought it was a great place when people ask him about the segregation. So he gets home, faces this moment of discrimination, and is so distraught he throws his gold medal into the Ohio River. Don't worry about it, he didn't do it. It's completely mythology. the sentiment is valid, of course. All of the black athletes who came back faced it in some way or another. But in fact, Clay had given it to somebody. They lost it. He made up this story to cover for the fact that he lost his gold medal. The world was coming, the new modern world was coming into view in so many different ways, not just the individualism of people like Cassius Clay, but television. These were the first commercially televised summer games. Yesterday, I was interviewed by Bob Costas, who will be the host at NBC. They're sending 4,000 people to Beijing. They're going to televise it for thousands of hours, literally, on 7 NBC networks and over the web. They spent a total of over $1 billion for the worldwide rights to the games. It all started in Rome. CBS was the first network to buy the rights. They spent less than $500,000. They sent a crew of fewer than 50 people to Rome, only 3 of whom were announcers. The host of the Olympics was Jim McKay, who had never done anything like that before. He came from being the daytime host of a courtroom drama called The Verdict Is Yours. He stayed in New York. He didn't even go to Rome. He stayed in a studio in Grand Central Station. This was before satellite coverage. Echo 2, the first satellite, was up in the air, but they didn't know how to use it to broadcast back over the Atlantic. So instead, they had video just starting then and film, and they would film the day's video, the day's events, put them in canisters, put them in the belly of a commercial jet, and fly them from Ciampano Airport in Rome back to Idlewild in New York, where they'd be taken by motor scooter over to Grand Central Station. Jim McKay is there in the editing room as the editors are figuring out what, you know, to cut and clip and paste for that day's events. He has a portable typewriter. He's typing out his script as they're working on that. You know, think about today with hundreds of researchers, you know, doing anybody's bidding. And there's Jim McKay typing out his script. If something happens on the screen and it's a country that he doesn't really know about, he turns to the Encyclopedia Britannica to get the information about the country. That's where it all began, from that to what we have today. Similarly, as I mentioned with Armin Hari, Rome was the beginning of sort of the breach of amateurism. But it's important to understand the context of why that happened. And as in so many avenues of sports, it begins with the manipulation and outright slavery, basically, of that athletes face, and then the reactions to that sometimes become overreactions. So the athletes in the West and the East had different conditions. In the East, in the Soviet Union and other places, it was basically state-sponsored. One of the reasons that Igor Tarovinessian, who I mentioned earlier, didn't defect was also because he was treated so well in the Soviet Union. He was a hero of the state. He had subsidized living quarters, better apartments than other people, as did most of the great athletes, and many other favors that in the West they didn't have. And so there was this sense that there was an uneven playing field because many of the Soviet and other athletes were in the army and basically subsidized for their athletic endeavors. Well, in the West, they didn't have that. They had these incredible draconian amateur rules. Rafer Johnson, the great decathlete, was told that he couldn't participate as an actor in the movie Spartacus. He trained at UCLA. Kirk Douglas happened to train there, too. He lived nearby, and he'd run on the track. He befriended Rafer Johnson and said, you know, I'm about to film this new movie in Rome, of all places. And, it'd be great. There's a role for a black slave. You know, I know you want to get into acting. This is your opportunity. Well, the powers that be said that if he took that role, he'd become a professional using his athletics to get this advancement. And so they said if he did it, he couldn't go to Rome. The worst example was of Lee Calhoun, a great hurdler who had won the gold medal in 1956 in the hurdles won again in Rome in 1960. But in between, he'd been suspended for an entire year because he and his college sweetheart, Gwen, got married on the TV show Bride and Groom. And, of course, they got some wedding presents as part of that show, and the leaders of amateurism decided that that was a breach of amateurism, and they suspended him for a year for that. I mean, it was all preposterous. But the context is sort of what made the definitions of amateurism? The athletes didn't make it. It was created by people like Avery Brundage, a rich millionaire developer from Chicago, and his cohorts in the International Olympic Committee, most of whom were royalists of some sort, and very wealthy men. The vice president of the IOC then was the Marquess of Exeter, who some of you will recognize when I tell you that he was a character in Chariots of Fire. He was the rich lord who set up champagne bottle glasses on the hurdles as he went over them. That was the Marquess of Exeter. Well, it's easy for people like that to say that of course you shouldn't take money for performing in athletics because they don't need the money. But most athletes come out of poverty and hunger and need, and it's a far different proposition for them. So they were calling Brundage slavery Avery. And it's really in that early stage when the whole notions of amateurism started to crack. Brundage was more than slavery Avery. He was a fascinating character. I spent a week at the archives at the University of Illinois where all of his papers are. I guess, you can define him in a lot of different ways, but for me it all goes back to 1936 when he was the leader of the American Olympic Committee, as it was called then. And there was a controversy over whether the United States should participate in the 1936 Games in Berlin and thereby give status to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. It was a very legitimate and difficult debate over how you handle that, as it always is on whether you should boycott or not. And many of the Jewish leaders in the United States and others were urging the U.S. to boycott those Olympics. Hitler loved the Olympics. The whole notion of it was very much fit right into the whole Nazi notion of grandeur and order. He's the one who invented the whole torch race to the stadium at the beginning of the Olympics. To be honest, the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, not the parade, but when they're all out in the infield doing all these dances and all, scare the hell out of me because it reminds me of Nuremberg or something like that. Anyway, Hitler loved all of that stuff. There was a debate over whether to go or not. Avery Brundage, the leader of the American delegation, was insistent that they not boycott. And in the archives, I found all of these letters documenting him writing to the German officials saying that there's a Jewish cabal in the United States that's trying to stop this, that the American writers in Berlin are writing all these negative stories about Hitler, and we've got to overcome that, and send me some clippings about all the good things they're doing. The U.S. participates. And the reason it's an interesting debate is because that's where Jesse Owens excelled and sort of had this marvelous effect on the world by what he did there. Of course, it didn't stop Hitler or the Holocaust and the horror to come. But in any case, the U.S. participates. Avery Brundage comes back after the Olympics. A couple of weeks later, there's a massive gathering at Madison Square Garden. 19,000 people fill the place to the rafters, German-American Bund, and Brundage is one of the guest speakers. And at that event, he talks about how there's a lot that America can learn from Hitler and the Nazis. For me, you don't have to go much further than that to make up your mind about Avery Brundage. I try to give him his humanity in the book, and I found it wonderfully ironic that in 1960 he was being criticized as a communist sympathizer because of his decision on Taiwan. The two central characters in my book are Rafer Johnson and Wilma Rudolph, not Cassius Clay. Cassius Clay became the most famous person, the most famous athlete in the world, but he wasn't in 1960, and it's important to put him in the context of that moment. Rafer Johnson, to me, is one of the great underappreciated athletes in American history. He was the greatest athlete of that era, the decathlete, And he was chosen to carry the American flag at the opening ceremony, which was a very important symbolic moment, because here you had the United States in this Cold War proclaiming itself as the beacon of liberty around the world, and at the same time being pounded by the Soviets, saying, how can you say that when millions of your own people are second-class citizens, including your best athletes? There's no real argument on the other side of that issue. And what became clear to me, and it's such an obvious point, but the research just sort of knocked me over the head with it, is that the Cold War, in effect, had a positive impact on civil rights in the United States because of the clear impossibility of the United States arguing that point. So the State Department, the Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration, in many ways was compelled to act in the United States on civil rights because of the clear hypocrisy that was presenting abroad, including in the Olympics and in athletic events. So they chose Rafer Johnson to carry the flag as a very important symbolic moment, and he deserved to do it. He was the captain of the team. He was the best athlete. All of the other athletes looked up to him, and yet he faced that conundrum that so many minorities and blacks face about sort of they know they're expected to behave a certain way, they're being used for certain reasons, and yet they deserve it. And so how do you respond to that? And Rafer Johnson felt that he was being manipulated, but also felt that he had the right to carry the flag, and it was important for him to do so. So he, you know, facing that contradiction, he chose to do it. It was a very important moment in American history, 8 years before the famous incident in Mexico City, where John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised the fisted gloves on the medal stand. That 8 years represents the difference in civil rights in America. But Rafer Johnson thought that the best way he could advance civil rights was first to be the greatest athlete in the world, and second to act with dignity, which in fact he did. My favorite story in the book, and perhaps the most meaningful, had to do with Wilma Rudolph and the Tiger Bells of Tennessee State University. Wilma Rudolph came out of a family of 22 kids in Clarksville, Tennessee. She had probably childhood polio. She was treated at Meharry Medical Center in Nashville, and the records don't exist, but people said she had polio, and she did have scarlet fever. I found that for certain. In any case, she had a withered leg as a child, wore a brace for several years. Then, at age 15, was part of the team that won the bronze medal in Melbourne in the relay race, came back to Clarksville, and got pregnant. So by the time she reached Rome in 1960, she'd overcome polio and braces and teenage pregnancy. And she went on to win 3 gold medals, the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash, and the relay race. And she did it with this incredible beauty. You look at the women athletes of today, and they're just different. They're more muscular. All their bodies are ripped. And Wilma was very lithe, long-limbed, and had just gorgeous sort of charm about the way she ran, very very lithe. And everybody in Rome was head over heels for her. All of the other athletes, every male athlete I talked to said, I was in love with Wilma. And I could have consummated that if I could only gotten closer to her. Cassius Clay was completely head over heels with her, so much so that after the Olympics, there's this great story. Ed Temple, the coach of the Tiger Bells, told me that his wife is looking out the window of their home in North Nashville. She yells out, "Hey, Ed, do you know anybody who drives a pink Cadillac?" And it was Cassius Clay, who'd driven down from Louisville to Nashville and was trying to find Wilma, and went to Coach Temple to find out where she was. Anyway, Wilma was just a beautiful star of the Olympics, and the fact that she overcame polio had an interesting effect on the other women athletes of those Olympics, particularly the swimmers. Because if you remember that era of the 1950s, there was sort of an alleged link between swimming pools and polio. And all of the young women swimmers had been told that they should be careful about being in swimming pools too much or they'd get polio. So to have this other great woman athlete overcome polio and be the star of the Olympics was very important to them. Wilma also became an international star because these Olympics were televised. So the whole world actually got to see her run. And as as important as Wilma was, I think the Tiger Bells as a group were even more wonderful to me. Here they were in this small school in North Nashville, historically black Tennessee State A&I University at that point. This was way before Title IX. There were no scholarships for women. There were hardly any women's programs in any college in the country. To compete, they competed against a couple of other historically black schools, Tuskegee Institute and Alabama State. Their coach, Ed Temple, was making about $1,000 a month, both coaching and teaching at the school. He didn't even have his own office. He shared an office with his wife, who was the postmaster of the small school. Their track was about two-thirds of a track, and it was full of cleat marks from the football team that practiced on the same field. They had no means of transportation other than a clunky station wagon that they drive to these events. And driving through the Jim Crow South in the 50s and 1960, they were hesitant to stop at service stations. When they had to go to the bathroom, the women would shout from the back, "It's time to hit the fields." They'd pull over to the side of the road to go to the bathroom. They wouldn't stop to eat. They'd pack peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the cars as they went. And out of that nothingness, just nothing except will and talent, came the greatest women's track and field team in history, the Tiger Bells of Tennessee State, who won 6 gold medals in Rome and went on for years thereafter. And really what they did and what Wilma did paved the way for so many women in the future, from Billie Jean King in tennis to track stars in later years. They all revere and talk about Wilma and the Tiger Bells as helping pave the way. Wilma did one other thing that I'll close on, which was a moment of real guts. After she won those 3 gold medals, her hometown, Clarksville, wanted to honor her with a parade and a banquet. And Wilma said no, not unless it's integrated. This was Jim Crow segregation in the South, and she was so famous at that point and so popular that the town fathers of Clarksville had to accede to her request. And for the first time, for at least one night, black officials and white officials and black families and white families in Clarksville sat together in the armory to celebrate Wilma Rudolph. Thank you very much.
I have just 2-part question. What surprised you the most as you researched the book based from your original perceptions going into it? And then of the people you interviewed during the course of the book, who did you find the most fascinating?
Sorry. You know, the question of what surprised me most is one I try to resist answering. And no offense to you, but everything in a book should surprise me. Otherwise, I'm not doing my research right. In other words, I try to take nothing for granted, okay. And I'm learning everything new. As I said earlier, that notion of how the Cold War had a positive effect on race relations didn't surprise me, but I just hadn't really thought about it as clearly before. Some of the stories that stuck with me had nothing to do with the great athletes, but with the losers. There's a part in the book that I call an interlude because I had to get it in the book, and it didn't really fit in the chronology of the book, but it was a story that I wanted to tell so badly. And it had to do with a high jumper named Joe Faust. He finished in 17th place for the Americans. And when I was out in Los Angeles, mostly spending days with Rayford Johnson and some of the other athletes who would be major characters in the book, I tried to interview everybody I could find who had competed in those Olympics. So I got a number for Joe Faust and called him up. He told me, "Sure, come on out." I map-quested where he lived and drove out. And I'm driving out, and it's getting more and more remote and barren. And finally I get to the street, and it's sort of an adobe hut on the side of a hill. And he's living there this incredibly Spartan life. It's one room with a cot and a computer and some books and a grill outside. And he starts to talk to me about high jumping and what it meant to him. And he was a very spiritual guy, a sort of a Catholic, but in a very intense, almost Buddhist form of Catholicism. And he said that high jumping to him was a form of cleansing, that he would rise with penance and descend with gratitude every time he jumped. When he got back from Rome after finishing in 17th place, he tried to join he tried to become a monk. It didn't quite work. He had too many thoughts about women. But here he is all these decades later, almost living a monk's life, an ascetic life. And so after we talked for about 3 hours, we went into his backyard. And it was a nutcase's backyard. I love these types of people. There was a collection of junk everywhere, you know, slabs of cement, iron bars, you know, rubber tires, you know, broken statues. They're just littered with junk. And as we kept walking toward the bottom of the yard, I saw this well-worn path coming across the yard. And then I looked over, and there was a battered mattress. And then I saw these two poles. And he was still high jumping, you know, rising with penance and descending with gratitude. It was just kind of amazing.
Thank you very much for your talk. You brought back a lot of memories and names of that period that I'd forgotten. But bringing you to the present a little bit, I'd like to hear your thoughts and your expectations about the Beijing Olympics, this combination of sports and politics, and also whether you plan on going.
I'm not going. I have asthma. I don't intend, my friend Michael Weisskopf here tonight lived over there for the Washington Post. And he and many others advised me that it's not the greatest place in the world for people like me. I don't have to go. I'd love to go to an Olympics. But I don't even think the Olympics should be held in Beijing, and not for the political reasons, but because it's not a great place for athletes to compete because of the horrible pollution there. In any case, as to how the Olympics will be perceived, I think it always runs on two tracks. You know, there's the sports and there's the politics. You're never going to get rid of the politics because it's one of those rare moments when the entire world is in the same place at the same time. So I think that, there'll be some amazing athletic moments. If the incredible Dara Torres wins a gold medal at age 41, I mean, that's just stunning. You know, in Rome, Donna Di Verona was 13 years old. You know, most swimmers are in their teens. And for her to do that at 41, I mean, that'll be an incredible story. Phelps might win 8 gold medals, who knows. There'll be other amazing stories. But I think that in history, the sports will recede and these Olympics will be remembered for what China does. You know, I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen. The entire world press is going to be there. All of the human rights issues, all the pollution issues, all of the turmoil of China at this moment could go either way in those 18 days. And it will be remembered as China introducing itself to the world at the dawn of what they consider their century, the 21st century, for better or worse. And I think that's how it will be remembered.
You mentioned that you kind of combed through the sports writing of the period of 1960, the Olympics. Could you talk a little bit more about the tenor of the coverage compared to then as it is to now? Is it better or worse? That kind of
different.
Different, yeah.
First of all, newspapers still dominated the media at that point, you know, which as a newspaper guy I love,
right?
Because television was just in its infancy in terms of sports coverage. CBS didn't even have a CBS sports department. It was the CBS News that did the Olympics. So it tended to be, it was good old days and bad old days. I mean, you know, it was a tribe of white male sports writers, some of whom I love. A.J. Liebling was in Rome covering it for The New Yorker. And, you know, the truth is, as much as I love Liebling, he was a product of his times. And he wouldn't get away with his characterizations of third world athletes in sort of a lovingly condescending way today that he did then. Red Smith then was writing for the New York Herald Tribune, later would be the New York Times columnist. I think he's the greatest sports columnist ever. He was acerbic and trenchant and usually right in his columns. Most of the other columnists tended to follow his lead or the lead of Shirley Povich, the great writer for the Washington Post, who was really ahead of his time, particularly on race relations. Povich's greatest lead ever had nothing to do with the Olympics, but it was when you know, the Redskins were the last team to integrate. You know, they were led by the racist owner. And the Cleveland Browns came to town, and Povich wrote, Jim Brown integrated the Redskins' end zone 3 times yesterday. any case, so you know, I loved reading Shirley Povich and Red Smith. Many of the others were kind of hacks who just followed their lead. Yeah. And as I said earlier, they were all pretty much sexist. It was just, you know, part of the times. They were all ogling the women athletes. So it was different. Most of the stories were positive. All of those cliches about, you know, the old way versus the new way. And I'm in the middle. You know, I love to read those old guys. Some of the new ones drive me nuts. and some of them are better than anyone, you know. So I just think you can find good writing and reporting in any era.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.